adventurers get trained, and plenty of them have the potential to rise to the top. Those are the ones who've come to Rimuros looking for that guild membership. They are. The lack of training halls like we're talking about is the reason a place like Greenstone falls short. There, if you don't come from a prominent family like Humphrey or Neil, then you're pretty much hoping that someone with more experience will mentor you. Danielle Geller established a training hall there after the expedition disaster. I remember, Jason said. She was just getting started before we went into the astral space. I even taught aura control there for a few weeks. It's more developed now, Rufus said. It doesn't offer the level of training that the Gellers give their people in-house, but it's open to all Essence users. They're even deferring payment until people get Adventure Society membership and earn enough to pay back the tuition fees. I even arranged for the Remora Academy graduates coming to Greenstone to do some basic instruction there. A trick I learned growing up around teachers is that having students teach each other is a great tool to consolidate learning. I found it complements the training annex programs very nicely. It's still early days, but I can see Greenstone's adventuring culture going through a qualitative shift over the next few decades. Sounds like you enjoy running a school.
It's just a training annex.
That you conceived of, developed, established, and ran. You're allowed to be proud of yourself, Rufus. It won't make your hair grow back.
Why would...
Rufus stopped himself. In their time apart, he'd forgotten the dangers of asking questions about Jason's nonsense.
If I'm being honest with myself, he said, I've enjoyed establishing the training annex more than I've missed adventuring. Helping others to avoid my mistakes is a lot more fulfilling than the constant dread of making the next one.
Jason's aura senses were utterly transformed from what they had been when he knew Rufus in the past, and now his friend was an open book to him. Jason always knew that Rufus and his team getting captured at the time Jason first met them, and then Farrah's death both weighed heavily on him. Now he could feel it inside Rufus like a wound. Even Farrah's return hadn't entirely erased it. He had a feeling that just like Gary had turned to his smithing, Rufus would turn to teaching rather than go back to the adventuring life. What that meant for Farrah remained to be seen.
That's nothing to be ashamed of, Jason said. Honestly, at this point, I think I'd rather be a tourist. All the fun parts of adventuring, but without stuff constantly trying to kill you and your friends. Sadly, that ship has sailed for me. I've got the Builder, then whatever comes next.
Next? All I've gotten from Dawn so far are ominous warnings. Whatever it is, I need to keep getting stronger, so it's the adventuring life for me. Honestly, I do like it when I'm not fighting and or being used by great astral beings, or gods, or forest nymphs who live in a baby oil factory.
What?
I've got to get lucky one of these days, right?
Rufus shook his head.
It's adventuring for me as well. The training annex is a pleasant distraction, but I chose to be an adventurer. If I step away from that, every person I could have helped and didn't is my responsibility. I paid the price for my mistakes, so now I have to use the lessons I took from them.
You're an idiot.
Rufus swiveled his head to look at Jason.
Excuse me?
Rufus, are you a good teacher? Wait, don't. Answer that. You'll say some humble crap, and I'm trying to make a point here. I know you're a good teacher because you taught me and I'm awesome. Even with my overwhelming natural talent, smouldering charisma, and dashing good looks helping you along, that's still a pretty good result.
Rufus gave him a flat look.
Now, Jason continued, flashing an impish grin. Let's just say you go back to adventuring and save one person's life a week, on average. Now, let's posit that instead, you go teaching young adventurers full-time. How many of them can you help avoid the mistakes that you made? How many of them are going to go off and save one person's life every week? If you look at it that way, then going back to adventuring is equivalent to killing a whole bunch of innocent people because you failed to train the adventurers that would have saved them.
Are you going to kill a bunch of innocent people, Rufus? That's cold.
Jason, I'm not Humphrey. I'm not going to accept some problem-riddled argument because you talked fast enough.
Mate, it's about the point, not the details. I've saved a lot of lives, Rufus.
Not mine as much as I'd like, but other people's. I'm sure Farrah told you all about Earth when I wasn't around.
She didn't think you'd want to tell it yourself.
That's because she's smarter than us. My point, Rufus, is that every life I saved is a life that you saved. You taught me how.
You and Farah and Gary. So when you tell me that going off and being a teacher is somehow abdicating responsibility, what I'm hearing is that everything you taught me and everything I've done with it isn't worth a damn, that you don't respect it. That's not what I'm saying. I hate to break it to you, Cobber, but that's exactly what you're saying. You're also bizarrely claiming that being a teacher is somehow selfish? That's a pile of crap so huge that you could make a living selling Rufus brand prime fertilizer. You think back to the people who taught you at this academy of yours. How many of them are shirking their responsibilities? They continued riding along the street on Shade's horse forms, Rufus falling into silent contemplation. He didn't share Jason's pathological need to get the last word. In a Waterlink chamber, Farah was talking with two water clones of her parents. The magic was sufficiently developed that they were indistinguishable from her actual parents to the eye. Magical senses revealed their nature as projections, which hadn't stopped her from taking a half step in the instinct to hug them when they appeared. After an emotional sort of reunion, they were coming to the end of their time in the chamber. Liara had scheduled a generous block, but communication was at an absolute premium.
"We're trying to get you here, along with Gary and Jason's companions," Farah told her parents. "It would be easier if we came to you, but Jason can't go anywhere without getting caught up in some huge mess."
"Yes, we've met him and he's a very nice boy," Farah's mother, Amelia, said. "A bit odd, but nice. If he brought you back to us, though, then he's family now."
"At worst, we'll make our way to you once the monster surge is over," Farah assured her.
"You just make sure and stay safe," said her father, William. "No foolish risks. We want you coming back to us safe and sound."
"Don't worry," Farah said. "I have an object lesson in foolish risks running around with me. I leave that sort of thing to him now."
Jason and Rufus dropped lightly to the street as Shade's horse forms dissolved into Jason's shadow. They were outside a boutique store, a simple cream-coloured building with a light linen suit hanging on a dummy in the open window, topped by a Panama hat. There was no indication of the shop's name or signage of any kind.
"Oh yeah," Jason said. "I'm getting one of those hats."
Jason opened the door for Rufus, then followed him inside. The interior was surprisingly spacious, the small storefront obscuring the fact that internally it was quite large. The left and right walls were covered in racks of fabric samples that leaned heavily towards light fabrics and shades appropriate to the climate. There were doors to the sides, large armchairs, and the back wall was completely open to a courtyard with what looked like an outdoor bar cafe. There were tables shrouded by parasols where people were sitting and chatting as they ate or drank. There were young couples, a trio of old men playing cards. Everyone was exquisitely, if casually, dressed. There were two people behind the bar, plus a cook in the kitchen behind it. The whole courtyard was filled with lush tropical plants. Two Celestine men entered from the courtyard. One was tall and handsome, with sharp cheekbones and gunmetal hair and eyes. His aura placed him at the peak of bronze rank. The man with him, Jason recognized as one of the Owls, although this one looked younger than the others he'd seen because of his silver rank. His aura was thick with monster cores, which was common in magical craftspeople. Most felt that chasing after monsters was a waste of time, better spent dedicated to their profession. Alorando Alberici had sea-green eyes and identically coloured hair that spilled back off his head in waves. He wore a flatteringly draped suit of white fabric. His cufflinks, shoes, and pocket square all matched the colour of his hair.
"Thank you for coming in, young Master Irios," Alorando was saying as the two men walked across the room.
"You were recommended to me. They said I should come in around now to catch you when you weren't busy."
Jason smiled thinly. He'd received the same recommendation, which he now suspected came from the same source. He tapped a small pin on his shirt, a new purchase, and an invisible sound screen surrounded Jason and Rufus.
"Remind me to punch Vespa Rimoros in the boob," he said.
"No," Rufus said, reaching out to tap the pin on Jason's shirt and shut the screen off. Jason and Rufus stepped aside as Alorando led the young man to the door. Alarando's gaze took in Jason at a glance, while the young man's eyes lingered a little longer on Rufus in passing.
"You will be contacted when your clothes are ready, Mr. Irios," Alarando said.
"Thank you, Mr. Alberici."
"Please call me Al."
As the young man Jason was certain to be named Casper Irios closed the door, Alarando turned to Jason and Rufus.
"You must be Jason Asano," he said. "I was instructed to offer you nothing but the best."
The door that had almost completely closed now froze in place, the young man's hand still gripping the handle. Chapter 41. Murky Waters. Jason felt the emotions play out in the auras around him. At the center was the man on the other side of the tailor shop's glass, Casper Irios. A peak-level bronze ranker, he stood frozen, gripping the handle of the almost closed door. His shock was as plainly written on his face as his aura after hearing Jason's name. The man who had spoken his name, Alarando Alberici, was a silver ranker. The moment he sensed the reaction of Casper, his welcoming aura filled with surprise and then suspicion with an underlying strain of anger. Jason realized that he wasn't party to the play being acted out, with whoever wrote the script remaining hidden in the wings. Rufus was confused, having picked up on the tension in Jason's body language and the obvious link to the man on the other side of the glass. He was smart enough to know that if he didn't have the information to act, he should keep his mouth shut and listen, looking at Jason for direction. Jason's aura was unreadable to the other silver rankers, but the anger over being played yet again flashed on his face before he schooled the expression.
"Mr. Alberici," Jason said, "this is Rufus Remore, out of Vitesse. I would appreciate you seeing to his needs while I take Mr. Irios for a little walk. Let's not make a scene in your place of business."
Alarando looked Jason in the eyes. Jason's aura revealed only its normal, polite facade, leaving him to assess Jason by what he could see. Jason wore his usual tourist-in-the-tropics outfit, but the tailor knew better than most that it was not clothes that made the man.
"Thank you, Mr. Asano. I appreciate the courtesy."
Casper Irios still gripped the handle of the almost closed door, letting go and stepping back as Jason pulled it open. The bronze ranker's movements were oddly stumbling for an adventurer, his physical unbalance revealing the depth of his mental equivalent.
"Casper Irios, I take it?" Jason asked. "I'm Jason Asano. Just to get it out of the way, yes, the dead one, you and I are going to take a little walk."
Casper's initial shock was giving way to wariness.
"How am I meant to know you are who you say?"
"It's a fair question," Jason said. "It's not every day your former fiancé's dead fake lover comes back to life. Not sure what to tell you, though. I don't think they make a greeting card for, 'Sorry I used your death to avoid a political marriage and got you caught up in a huge mess, although in fairness you were dead and that's not something I had a reasonable expectation of you coming back from.' It'd be hard to fit on the cover, if nothing else."
"What are you talking about? What's a greeting card?"
"Right, other world. Do you have gift baskets here?"
Yes. I'm not sure what...
"A greeting card is like that, except instead of being full of nice things, it's a piece of cardstock. It's like a social puzzle, where you have to figure out how long you need to leave it sitting around before you can throw it away without being rude."
Jason tapped the pin on his chest, and an invisible privacy screen shielded them from eavesdropping. It wasn't impenetrable, but anyone who could do so without Jason noticing was out of his league anyway. It would be enough to stop the hidden observers Jason could sense already paying them attention.
"Let's walk, Mr. Irios."
Jason felt fear from the bronze ranker.
"I'm not sure I should be going places with you."
"We're not going anywhere," Jason said. "We're just going to wander around on the street a little in front of plenty of people and have a nice chat."
Well, a chat, anyway. They walked along the street side by side. The streets were wide shopping boulevards with plenty of other traffic, both on foot and using various means of transport. They were far from the only people using privacy screens, unseen to the eye but visible to magical senses. Alarando's shop front was part of a shopping district located between the more open market district and the more industrious craftsman's quarter.
It was comprised of boutique stores catering to adventurers, nobility, and the wealthy. Many of the people walking the street were all three, making anyone that caused trouble very stupid indeed. Jason and Casper wandered along the street, in awkward silence at first. Jason noted that many glances were cast at Casper by the people on the street. He guessed locals recognized either the House Irios crest on the arm of his clothes, or Casper himself, although no one greeted him as they passed. "Mr. Irios, someone told you to come here, and they didn't tell you the real reason why. We're both dancing on someone's palm. And I don't know about you, but I don't like that. That being said, we need to step carefully. I've had my share of lessons in getting out of one mess by making a bigger one, and we both know that you have as well." "I'm still not taking your word for who you claim to be."
"Nor should you," Jason agreed. "The whole point of having us meet like this is so that you will go out and investigate, or more precisely, so your family will. That's one of several reasons someone arranged for us to meet like this. Someone wants to stir up murky waters."
"Who?"
"House Irios and the royal family are both looking to settle things down after the mess that you and Zara made. The exact who doesn't matter right now. First, you need to make sure that I am who I say I am. My return brings certain things to a head, which your family will need to handle carefully. You yourself will need some time to process. I certainly did. I come back from the dead and find that instead of the nice, quiet stay in the tropics, I'm suddenly the dead paramour of some princess I met a couple of times 3 years ago. Plus, the builder's trying to assassinate me again, but that bit's not on you."
"What?"
"Look, mate, you just found out that, one, I'm alive, and two, I'm here. There are ramifications that need to be thought through. Someone, who is going to get a good talking to, decided that having you and me bump into one another, oh so coincidentally, would be a good way to do that murky water stirring."
"Why?"
"Probably to see if we make a scene. They're still trying to figure out how I handle myself and need to know if I'm reliable when put on the spot. I need to be a little bit of a controversial figure for what comes next, so a public confrontation between you and me wouldn't hurt that goal. As for you, you've made trouble before. They want to know if you'll do something stupid, like run off to Zara and cook up another terrible plan."
"I don't think I should be talking to you."
"Correct," Jason said. "What you need to do is go home, tell your family that you met me, and have a nice long think and a nice long talk with them. After that, you do what they tell you." Casper went to respond, but Jason silenced him with a gesture. "Now, I'm going to tell you what you shouldn't do. You should not go find your friend Zara and have her devise some plan to get some control over the situation that sets in motion a cascade of events that ruins everything for you, me, her, your family, the royal family, and thousands of people who are relying on all of the above to keep them safe."
"Oh, hey, Casper."
A trio of young men in fine clothes was approaching them with waved greetings. They were all bronze rank, but close to silver, like Casper himself. One wore a loose robe of light, breathable fabric with the colours and emblem of the Magic Society. Not all Magic Society members were also adventurers, and the monster cores in this young man's aura suggested he was not. His aura control was solid, though, so he was not untrained. The other two were more likely adventurers, judging from their clean auras. One wore a long jacket covered in pockets and potion vial loops, marking him as an alchemist. The third bore no identifying equipment, but Jason noted the precision of his movement and his attentiveness to the surroundings. He was also so close to silver rank, Jason bet he could almost taste it. Of the three, Jason pegged him as the most capable. Jason tapped his pin to drop the privacy screen.
"Hey, Cass," the Magic Society member said. "I thought the family had you bundled up indoors when you weren't out on a contract."
I came out to order some clothes."
The three picked up on Casper's nervousness and moved their attention to its obvious source.
"Who's your friend, Cass?"
the alchemist asked protectively.
"Casper's a little busy," Jason said.
"You can catch up with him later." Alongside his words, he sent a little stream of aura to the third member of the group, giving him a glimpse of what lay behind Jason's polite aura facade. The young man put a hand on each of his two friends' shoulders.
"We'll catch up with him later,"
he said, echoing Jason's words. The other two looked from Jason to their friend, who shook his head, then back to Jason.
All right, Cass, the alchemist said. We'll come and find you at home.
Thank you, Hills, Casper said. I'll see you all later then. The trio moved on, throwing curious looks back at Jason.
You know those three are going to talk, Casper said.
Jason reinstated the privacy screen. My return is going to bring issues around you and Zara to the fore, Jason said. Events are being set in motion. Your family, and now those three, are going to ask questions. When they do, undercurrents will start to flow.
I think I do need to go home.
Yes, you do, Jason said.
Look, I know what you're going through. You just found out a bunch of crazy stuff. You haven't had time to sort through it, and there's some guy who won't stop talking. And you understand maybe a third of what he's saying at best?
You need to stop, take stock, and sort through everything.
Talk to your family.
Casper nodded. Good. Now, someone from your family will want to talk to me. You probably will too, once you've had time to sit with this for a while. When you're ready, come find me on Arnott. I'm staying in a little town called Palisoros. Ask for me by name and someone will point you my way.
Casper took a personal floater disc from the dimensional bag on his hip. Before he stepped onto it, he turned to look at Jason.
If you are who you say, I want you to know I'm sorry, he said.
It never felt right using your name the way we did. It's just...
Better to invoke the dead than hurt the living? Casper nodded.
I won't say I wasn't angry, Jason said.
I was? Still am, to be honest. But that doesn't help us right now. I can yell at you in private once you come find me.
Does Zara know?
You didn't talk to her?
Her family keeps her on a narrow line since everything happened. We don't see each other much anymore. She said it wouldn't look good anyway.
Casper gave Jason a sad smile, stepped onto his float disc, and drifted off. Jason watched him go, then tapped his pin to drop the privacy screen and walked back towards the tailor shop.
Tell your boss, he muttered. The next time she wants me to dance, if she doesn't tell me before the music starts, I'll be stomping on her feet.
He sensed the hidden observers start moving away. Adventure Society Director was a prominent position in any community. In a major adventuring hub like Rimuros, that was even more true. It was a demanding and high-pressure job, although the prestige and social standing that came with it were not inconsiderable. The director mixed with kings and queens, famous adventurers, and foreign dignitaries. A director who did their job well found that once they moved on from the position, many doors would open to them. Those that fell short dropped into a pit of obscurity from which there was no escape. Gil Vinatos was the current occupant of the position, and fully aware that his performance in the coming weeks would define the rest of his life. An unprecedented monster surge and the Builder invasion were more than enough, even without the reports that were coming in from around the world. For someone like him, who worked their way up from the bottom through solid administrative skills, it was a critical time. He was taking a much-needed break, although he didn't have time for a long one. Lying out on his office couch, eyes closed as he ate sliced fruit from a bowl sitting on his chest, was the most relaxation he could afford before he had to get back to work.
A well-earned break, Mr. Vinatos.
Gil sat bolt upright, the bowl tumbling to the floor. He couldn't sense the person who had just spoken at all despite his gold rank senses. Admittedly, his rank came from monster cores, but he had been diligent in his training. He was also the director of the Adventure Society, so his office was a place both very difficult and very foolish to break into. He saw a man sitting on the edge of his desk, emitting no discernible aura at all. Gil was about to ask who he was when he recognized the face. In the heart of the royal palace, which Gil had visited many times, was a hallway full of portraits that led to the throne room. He had spent a considerable amount of time waiting outside to be admitted, and had looked over the closest portraits more than a few times. Gil recognized the man in front of him from one of those portraits, the one at the very end, right next to the throne room doors.
I'm sorry, Mr. Vinatos. I've made you drop your fruit.
Chapter 42. Integrity is Forever. Gil picked up his fruit from the floor, lamenting that he'd been too startled to catch it when normally his gold rank reflexes would have no trouble doing so. Then he realized that Soromir could also have caught them even more easily, but quickly quashed his annoyance at that. He looked up sheepishly. The diamond ranker would have certainly sensed the emotion and where it was directed.
"Don't concern yourself, Mr. Vinatos. I'm not here to make things harder for you."
Gil looked down at the bowl of fruit slices now covered in carpet fluff. He absently considered that he should have picked a carpet that handled the humidity better.
"Of course not, Ancestral Majesty."
Gil moved to his desk and sat the bowl down. Soromir stopped leaning on the desk and took one of the seats as Gil moved behind the desk before doing likewise.
"To what do I owe the honor?" Gil asked. "Is this related to the Builder City? Her Highness Princess Zila informed me that you were monitoring it."
Even during a monster surge, diamond rankers worked with the Adventure Society, not for the Adventure Society.
"Several of my peers are currently watching it in rotation," Soromir said. "We shall, of course, keep you apprised of anything relevant to Adventure Society operations or threatening to the kingdom."
"Then what can I do for you, Ancestral Majesty?"
"I need for you to arrange to have some people portaled here from Vitesse. 6 silver rankers and 2 bronze.
Obviously you're aware of how tightly regulated high-rank portal personnel are right now. While I respect the royal family, and you in particular, I can't ask the Vitesse branch to make that kind of allocation without a valid reason."
Gil opened a drawer and took out a sheet of paper.
"Curiously," he said, "I just received a similar request from Vitesse. They want 2 silver rankers portaled in the other direction. Normally, I would suggest that we could save on resources by using the same portal specialist to send one group across and then the other back. Given the people making these requests, however, I have a sneaking suspicion that they are related."
Gil handed the paper over to Soromir, who glanced it over.
"Jason Asano and Farah Hurin," Soromir read. "Why am I not surprised? Your assumption is quite accurate."
He put the paper on the desk, tapping it with his finger.
"This does not state the reason for the request."
"It's related to events taking place in the northern regions of Estacost. The Vitesse branch sent out an expedition to attack a Purity Church stronghold and got more than they bargained for. It's quite a mess right now, but somehow this Asano is involved. I'm having the analytical office prepare a full report for me to look at before I respond to the request."
"Asano cannot be allowed to leave the Sea of Storms right now. You need to deny the request."
"With respect, Ancestral Majesty, while I am open to any request you wish to make of this office, it's just that, a request. You don't tell this office what it can and cannot do."
Soromir raised his eyebrows in surprise, then nodded his approval.
"I respect that, Mr. Vinatos.
Director Vinatos, Ancestral Majesty, for this conversation, it's Director Vinatos."
"Of course, Director. Let me share my reasoning. During my time away, I became aware of preparations being made for the invasion of our world and returned to help the Storm Kingdom weather those events. Since my return to Rimuros, I have been investigating the activities of the Builder Cult. I've even discreetly been throwing some assistance to the Adventure Society's Builder Response Unit. This was not reported to me. They don't know I've been assisting them. I've recently contacted one of their leaders, my descendant Liara. I will be working more closely with them going forward, so you can anticipate reports on the activities in question."
"That is much appreciated."
"One of the things I discovered was that several months ago, the Builder Cult undertook some kind of infrastructure project buried underneath an uninhabited island.
They then abandoned the island entirely, so that their work couldn't be found unless you knew how to look. Which you did, I assume. Yes. It was some manner of astral beacon, like other astral magic being used by the cult. It was very advanced, by the standards of this world. My initial thought was that it was a launch point for the coming invasion. Did you destroy it? I decided not to. The advantage in knowing where the enemy would arrive is considerable, as you can no doubt imagine. However, it was not an invasion force that came through, but two silver rankers, both of whom were listed as having died fighting the Builder cult several years ago. The Builder resurrected them? No. Asano is an outworlder and was resurrected on his own world. I believe he had an object called a World Phoenix Token that revived him and sent him back where he came from. As for his companion, she seems to have become an outworlder after her death by likewise resurrecting in Asano's home world. As for the specifics, I have no idea.
There must be quite a story there.
Yes, although they have chosen to share very little thus far.
They're silver rankers. That isn't a choice they get to make. I'll have them brought in and...
I would hold off on that, Director Vinatos. If Asano has the backing that I suspect, he needs to be treated carefully. Not only will that mean there are powerful forces behind him, but also that he has an important role to play.
Then perhaps you should go to him personally. The attention of a diamond ranker, especially one as prestigious as you, will be flattering, and get him on side.
I have already met Mr. Asano, but it turns out that he's grown tired of dealing with people far more powerful than he. Rather than impressed, he was annoyed and angry, because of the way he seems to have been treated in the past. I believe that he will respond positively to forthright honesty and plain dealing.
Is that what your portal request is related to?
Yes, I want his team brought here to join him. Vitesse wants him there. Our needs outweigh their wants. My understanding is that Asano himself found a means to return to our world, but the Builder had his people use the beacon to determine his arrival point. For some reason, the Builder wanted him here.
Isn't that a good reason to send him away?
I believe the Builder's intention in bringing him here was to have him killed. The Builder has apparently agreed to some kind of restriction on how he attempts to do so, and so has made concessions to his Church of Purity allies to have them do it instead. One attempt has already been made. The Builder Response Unit is already working to interrogate the Purity Loyalists we captured in the process.
One of the Church's more extreme orders has been operating in this part of the world for many years. Gil said. It's unsurprising that they remained loyal. But what makes Asano worth all this attention?
Asano has already foiled the Builder's plans more than once, and I believe is now affiliated with the Builder's greatest antagonist. What part Asano has left to play is unclear, but even before his death, he demonstrated an effect on those who wield the Builder's power. He is, in fact, responsible for the very first live capture of someone with a starseed.
That's all well and good, Gil said, but I'm not sure that my Vitesse counterpart will be willing to accommodate you. The information I'm getting is still unclear, but they've had some unusual events that somehow this Asano is connected to.
Soromir nodded. I would appreciate that report, Director, once your people have completed it.
They should have it to me within the day, depending on what information we can get out of Vitesse. I think the best solution, for the moment, is to wait for more information before making any firm decisions. There may be something you are overlooking, however.
Oh? Soromir asked.
Asano himself.
We can ask him to go to Vitesse, but not tell him. While the Adventure Society can ask quite firmly, he always has the option to refuse.
If you can convince him to stay, my office will support the decision. We can make him available to the Vitesse branch via Waterlink, which is exactly why we monopolize the links in the first place.
Soromir nodded, stood up and offered his hand to Gil over the desk.
Thank you, Director Vinatos. Gil shook Soromir's hand, a little nervously.
I'll do my best to accommodate you, Your Majesty, but my first loyalty must be to my position.
Of course.
Jason returned to sensual attire for the sensual gentleman at Orlando Alberici's tailor shop. Rufus was sitting in the cafe courtyard, sipping on a cup of tea.
You took your time, Rufus said as Jason sat down. You didn't kill the boy and bury him in the jungle, did you?
What has Farah been telling you?
Just wanted to make sure.
We just had a little talk, Jason said. I told him to go home and not make any trouble. That's the only thing I did. I definitely didn't stop for shopping on the way back.
Rufus looked at him from under raised eyebrows.
I mean, there was a whole shop for skill books. How could I not buy some for cooking magic? I don't have time to learn all about the magical ingredients and how to handle them without diverting time from training. You know how often people try to kill me.
Have you heard anything about the people who were caught making the last attempt?
I've been told I'll be kept updated, although how reliable that assurance is remains to be seen. Liara said they'll probably want to involve me in the questioning.
You really know how to get caught up in messes, don't you?
You said it was normal for outworlders to get caught up in stuff. You told me that the day we met.
There's caught up and then there's you, Jason. I don't suppose you'd like to explain what this latest thing is. If that was Casper Idios, then is this about...
Yeah, but no details here. Back home, with Farah. No point in explaining it twice.
Right.
Did Elorando set you up with some good clothes?
He measured me up while you were off on your latest debacle. I didn't have any good hot weather clothes, so once my new outfits are finished, I'll be appreciative.
Haven't you been living in Greenstone? That place is half desert, half sweltering delta. How did you not pick up any warm weather outfits?
You know what the clothes are like there. It's as if someone threw up a rainbow of loose fabric and people just draped it over themselves. You know Gary still dresses like that. Although given what most Leonids wear, anything is a step up.
I didn't realize you were such a slave to fashion.
The problem with Mr. Ramor, Adorando said, approaching their table, is that for him, fashion is pointless. Look at the man. You could put him in a brown sack and he'd still be a work of art.
Tell me about it, Jason said, standing to shake Adorando's hand.
Mr. Asano, I apologize for my part in whatever political imbroglio you have been caught up in.
You get used to it, Jason said. At least with politics, they only stab you in the back. It's a nice change from being stabbed in the everything.
They left Rufus to his tea, and Elorando led Jason to his measuring room.
I have been directed to take your outfits in a certain direction,
Elorando explained as they walked.
That puts me in a slightly complicated position, as while I always strive to meet the needs of my client, the person wearing the clothes and the person paying for them is usually the same.
Wait, she already paid you?
Payment has been promised in full.
Forget that, Jason said. I'm the client, I'm paying you, and the only needs you have to meet are mine.
Elorando opened a door, ushered Jason inside, and then followed, closing it behind him.
That simplifies things for me a great deal, Elorando said. I especially do not like serving a client that attempts to employ me as a means to scheme against my clientele.
It won't be an issue to push back against the royal family?
Political favor is for today, Mr. Asano. Integrity is forever. If you would be so kind as to go into the measuring stall.
There was what looked like a changing room that Jason stepped into, closing the door behind him.
Please disrobe down to your underwear for the most accurate measurements,
Elorando said through the door.
Do you have any shape or size-changing powers we need to accommodate?
Just some conjured shadow arms, Jason said. Nothing a normal fit can't handle.
Excellent. We will have a full range of fabric and cut selection, then. Just let me know when you are ready for measurements, Mr. Asano.
Go ahead, Mr. Alberici.
Please do call me Al.
Only if you call me Jason.
It's a deal. You're going to experience some slight tingling.
Light emitted from the walls of the stall around Jason, starting with cool green, going through blue, purple, and then into warm red, yellow, and orange before fading away.
All done, Mr. Asano. Jason, please put your clothes on and come back out.
A few moments later, Jason was back out in the room, which was lined in wall-to-ceiling fabric racks.
Now, there is the matter of what you are looking for, Elorando said. What can I do for you today?
I'm looking for a full silver rank wardrobe refresh. I need everything, with plenty of options across the board, formal, casual, the lot.
And what kind of budget are we looking at?
Whatever it costs.
Jason, I think you and I are going to get on very well.
Chapter 43. How deep a hole? Jason went into the waterfall cave beneath his cloud house. The natural stone was hidden behind walls, floor, and ceiling made from cloud stuff, leaving only the cave mouth with the water rushing past.
Sunshine sparkled through it like a spray of diamonds, dancing into the room. The space was otherwise lit by soft, ambient light coming from the cloud stuff. The room was mostly empty, aside from boards formed out of cloud stuff on the walls. Jason could write or draw on them with only a thought, and they were already full of sophisticated magical diagrams and formulas. While his understanding of astral forces was instinctive and powerful, his knowledge of astral magic theory lagged. It had made great leaps, especially over the last year, but it was still not at the level required to finalize his special project. "I need Clive," he muttered as he glanced across his work. Then he put it out of his mind, and a crystal recording projector rose from the middle of the floor. Jason took out a recording crystal and set it in place before stepping back. He sat, a cloud chair emerging from the floor to meet him. Jason started the projector with a mental command. The projection showed dawn in the cloud house in Venice, at a time when Jason was in the first transformation zone on Earth. Jason had only seen her once since, shortly before the transformation zone's collapse. That had been the only time he saw her true form instead of a weakened avatar.
"Jason," the projected Dawn said, "my dimensional vessel has detected the approach of a similar vessel belonging to my counterpart within the Builder's people. This is a man I know, and based on my knowledge of him and you, I have some idea of how this is going to go. I'm not sure how far you will end up pushing him, but like so many beings of great power, that power has made him prideful."
Dawn paused as Emmy came into the room.
"Dawn, do you want to come play El Grande?"
"I'm a little busy."
"Okay."
Dawn turned back to the recording crystal she was speaking into.
"This man I suspect you're about to meet is going to make a mistake. I could probably stop him, but the concessions we can get from him if I don't are worth more than preventing him from acting, even if the cost is high. I'll explain the terms I will extract from him now, since we likely won't have long to talk the next time we meet."
Jason listened again as Dawn explained the terms about the Builder not attacking Jason with overwhelming numbers or high rankers. That he would not send anyone at all unless Jason interfered in their affairs first.
"I did remember right," Jason murmured to himself.
"Since I won't have a lot of time to explain when I see you, I'm going to leave this recording with Farah. She'll give it to you before you travel once more to the other world. I have no doubt that you'll succeed in saving your world and returning."
The recording ended, and Jason got up, returning the crystal to his inventory. Like most major organizations in Vitesse, the Adventure Society branch was located in one of the city's iconic garden towers, massive spires draped in greenery. In a meeting room that opened onto a balcony that let in the fresh air, Clive sat opposite a high-ranking Magic Society official. Various functionaries stood behind the official, while Clive was flanked by his team.
"Mr. Standish, you are one of the most talented young astral magic specialists we have."
"You don't have me," Clive said. "I left the Magic Society, definitively.
It's time to come home. You can accomplish more in research than you ever could as an adventurer."
"I beg to differ," Humphrey said. Clive was the mastermind behind both finding the Purity Enclave and the attack that disrupted their grand summoning.
"And how did he find them?" the official shot back. "By tracing them through a network of dimensional gates that he discovered while cloistered in research at the Magic Society."
"That's an awfully nice way of saying locked up," Sophie said.
"Mistakes were made," the official acknowledged. "We apologize for your previous treatment, Mr. Standish."
"Oh, we know how sorry you are," Neil said. "You think we haven't been paying attention." We have been following the career of the woman that exploited Clive, Humphrey said. Her next promotion got delayed because she kidnapped my team member. She got it eventually and is still running around quite happily. You Magic Society guys really know how to bring down the hammer, Neil said.
Mr. Standish, this mass arrival of Outworlders represents an unprecedented chance to study astral forces, which is more critical now than ever. We still don't know if the messengers that were summoned represent an isolated event or were part of a widespread program.
You wouldn't even know to ask if Clive wasn't an adventurer, Belinda said.
And that's the way I'm staying, Clive added. Not only did the Magic Society treat me with flagrant indecency, but your response in the aftermath was to hush it all up. Whatever unfortunate matters are in the past, the official said, we need to look to the future. You are more valuable researching the Builder and Purity's methods than getting killed fighting some irrelevant monster.
I don't know how to be more explicit, Clive said. I'm not returning to the Magic Society. Not ever.
You burned that bridge, Sophie told the official. Then you took the ashes, put them in a big trough, and got a bunch of your Magic Society friends to whiz in it. Then you used the resulting paste to write, we gave Clive the hard shaft, in letters so big that you need to fly to read them.
Everyone turned to Sophie.
What she said,
Belinda agreed, throwing an arm around Sophie's shoulder. The increasingly disgruntled official was about to speak when he noticed something approaching through the air directly towards the balcony. It was an elf standing on the back of a giant, white-feathered duck gliding through the sky. As it reached the balcony, the duck transformed into motes of light that sank into the elf's hair, turning it from a sandy blonde to stark white. Ken dropped lightly onto the balcony and strode into the room.
Well? Humphrey asked. It is done.
Grins crossed the faces of Humphrey and his team.
What's done?
The official asked. I dare say you shall learn soon enough, Ken said. Soon indeed, if the man I hear running down the hall outside is one of yours. True to Ken's word, the meeting room door burst open to admit a harried-looking man in Magic Society robes. He moved to the official and activated a privacy screen. The team then watched the anxious man rapidly speak, unable to hear his words, although seeing the official's explosive but equally silent reaction. The man shot up from his chair and turned to glare daggers at Humphrey. He didn't bother to address the team before storming out of the privacy screen, the startling functionaries trailing like ducklings. They heard him yelling as they moved down the hallway.
What a getter, pirates!
Warehouse District 3 was one of the least lucrative on the island of Liveros. Being the farthest from both the sea and sky docks, it was the closest thing to a criminal district on the security-conscious island of adventurers. One of the warehouses looked like any other from the outside, although the interior was entirely different, having been converted into an opulent home. Along with the plush furniture and smooth marble, it was further enhanced with magical infrastructure offering a formidable balance of protection and discretion. Only the most powerful senses would notice any difference between the building and the identical-looking ones around it. Harvey Estos owned the building, although it would take an adept bureaucrat to trace it back to him. Palimastus had nothing compared to Earth in terms of complex legalities and internecine paperwork, which made those with the knowledge and inclination to use them especially dangerous. Javi was a Celestine man of striking appearance. His large physique and onyx black skin were set off by his hair and eyes of matching gold. He looked well into middle age, despite the anti-aging effects of his silver rank. His aura was free of cause, the legacy of a long finished adventuring career. Contrary to his arresting appearance, he was not a man who liked to draw attention. Even so, he did his part during the monster surge, making sure that his activity quota was met. Upon returning from a contract, he was given a package that had been delivered to one of his public officers. It was from a friend from the old days, Mordant Kerr, who was now living somewhere in the western reaches of the Storm Kingdom. Inside his office, Javi watched the recording crystal included in the package while reading the letter, his eyes moving back and forth from one to the other. The projection gave a bird's-eye view of a river canyon where a shadowy figure fought monsters swarming over the ground like ants. He watched the projection to the end, his expression unchanging.
Affliction Skirmisher,
he muttered to himself.
Haven't seen one of those in a long time.
He called his assistant, Jono, into the room. Jono was also his great-nephew, although Javi tried not to hold it against him.
Yes, boss?
I need you to give Warnock a name.
Boss, she wasn't happy after last time. She's going to want extra.
So pay her extra.
Yes, boss. What's the name?
Jason Asano.
The capital city of the nation of Estacot was Sirion, home to the Adventure Society's Continental Council. It was closer than Vitesse to the site of the operation that turned into a debacle of magical explosions, summoned messengers, and unexpected outworlders. Since the operation had been launched out of Vitesse, that branch of the Adventure Society had been undertaking the initial management. In the aftermath, they handed off control of the site to the Sirion branch. Operations were shifting to Sirion for two reasons, of which one was simple geography. It had taken place in their backyard, and they were better located to handle what was looking like an ongoing operation. The other reason was that the Continental Council was taking an interest, as it turned out to be much more critical than originally thought. What was initially thought to be a sweep-up operation on low and mid-rank purity loyalists was revealed to be a grand summoning. Only made possible by the weakened dimensional protection the world suffered during the monster surge, it didn't take a lot of imagination to consider that this might just be the beginning. If there were more summoning events, it would have to take place during the monster surge. After the Adventure Society's operation forced an early launch, any other locations were likely pressing to do the same. Aggressive investigations were already being set into motion. The Magic Society had taken charge of the Outworlders, more than 100 of them in total. They were being transported to Sirion via airship, when several other airships moved into formation around them. A single woman with dark olive skin, black hair, and a gold rank aura leapt onto the surrounded airship alone. A less than satisfied Magic Society official listened to her explain that the Geller family would be providing the accommodation to the Outworlders at their fortified estate outside of Sirion. The official did not like the idea.
While you may be disinclined to go along with this, Danielle told him, if you refuse to cooperate, I will insist. You aren't going to make me insist, are you?
Trenchant Moore was reading through the Adventure Society file of Jason Asano that he hadn't been given before meeting the man in order to assess him without bias. Vesper Rimeros was already in the meeting room with him, and they were joined by Liara and her team members, Ledev and Yana. Trenchant stood as Liara entered and she waved him back to his seat. Ledev and Yana politely greeted the other princess. Rimeros High Society thrived on hierarchy. While Vespa and Liara were close friends in private, in public their behaviour was dictated by station. This was restricted to the Rimeros High Society, as foreign adventurers and those risen from humble beginnings were hardly expected to understand the sophisticated etiquette protocols. This inevitably did not stop some from looking down on those not raised in that world. This especially plagued those in the middle rungs, who watched people that should be below them not sharing their deference to those above. When a group was entirely made up of Rimeros locals, things could get complex, even in a simple meeting. The hierarchy of the room was determined by rank and the roles individuals were serving in during any given interaction. As gold rankers, Trenchant, Yana, and Ledev stood above the silver rank Vespa in the social hierarchy, but she was also a princess. Liara was a gold rank princess and nominally held eminence, but Vespa was from a higher branch of the royal family. Trenchant was an explicit servant of the royal family, being a member of the royal guard. He was not on duty, however, and was acting in his capacity as a gold rank adventurer. Further, he was the oldest and most experienced adventurer in the room. There was a familiar awkwardness as the people in the room took seats according to their relative positions. Even the fact that most people in the meeting didn't know its purpose affected their standing. Outside of a formal setting, most people defaulted to a respectful politeness of vague equality when the specific protocols were murky.
"If I may ask, Your Highnesses," Ledev said to Vespa. "Why are we here?"
"I need an assessment of Jason Asano's capabilities as an adventurer," Vespa said. "In short, I need to know how far he can be pushed as an adventurer."
This boy again, Ledev complained. That earned him a glare from his sister. He immediately looked contrite. I apologize, Your Highness, he said to Vesper. I simply fail to see why one silver rank adventurer warrants this much attention. Just look at the people in this room. We represent a powerful, prestigious, and valuable force in dangerous and important times. What makes him worth having us gather like this? He's not even in a guild.
The man himself doesn't matter, Vesper said. If someone else was in his position, we would be looking at them instead. In fairness to Asano, he never asked or attempted to be in the position he finds himself.
Quite the opposite, in fact, Liara said. While many young adventurers might relish the attention of high rankers and royalty, he is aggravated by it. He's had to deal with enough powerful people in the past that the sheen has certainly worn away. Constantly dealing with those who significantly outmatch you would engender a sense of powerlessness.
He certainly isn't intimidated by gold rankers, Trenchant said. I'm not often spoken to like I'm someone's flunky. The fact that he immediately saw why I was there and clearly knew more than I only made it worse.
He's arrogant, Ledev said.
You said it yourself, Ledev, Yana told her brother.
Look at the people in this room. If meetings like this were being held about me, I'd be arrogant too.
Why are we having this meeting? Trenchant asked.
I need an assessment of Asano's abilities as an adventurer, Vesper said. We need to know how far we can push him.
Why? Trenchant asked. You said he is in some position without actually explaining what that position was.
It's complicated, Vesper said, and political. And it is only made worse because Asano is a valuable asset against the Builder, unrelated to anything else, Liara added. His experiences against the Builder and the cult have left him with some unique capabilities.
Suffice to say, Vesper said, that a very annoying man is at the crux of certain events. Who he is doesn't matter, only whether he makes a mess or helps us clear it up. What we need right now is to highlight Asano's capability with some contracts that would get him noticed, which means knowing how deep a hole we can throw him in with a reasonable expectation of his climbing back out.
Chapter 44. The Part That Knows How to Quit. On the Adventure Society campus, Princesses Vesper and Liara were in a conference room with Trenchant Moore and Liara's teammates, Yana and Ledev. The room's privacy magic was active.
Let's start with you, Ledev, Liara said. What is your assessment of Asano?
He's capable enough, guild level and strong alone. His aura is formidable. He excels in solitary action, but would be harder to incorporate into a team. His methods are unconventional for an affliction user.
Trenchant Moore tossed the folder containing Jason's file onto the table.
This assessment is wrong, he said. It lists Asano as an affliction-using generalist. He's a specialist.
You consider him focused enough to be considered an affliction specialist?
Vesper asked.
He's not an affliction specialist, Trenchant said. Not as that term is commonly used. What is now called an affliction specialist used to be known as an affliction mage or affliction spellcaster. This is the commonly known approach of standing behind a wall of allies or summons and blanketing the enemy with afflictions from a safe distance.
That isn't anything like what Asano does, Yana said. We saw him go through several encounters, and while he does use familiars, it's never to put them between himself and the enemy.
He's an affliction skirmisher, Trenchant said. Hit-and-run tactics, high mobility, high efficiency. It's a specialization that rarely appears, and those that have it tend to die early, so you don't see it often. Affliction skirmishers have a low margin of error, and their survival is all about how well they expand that margin.
How do they compare to traditional affliction specialists? Vesper asked. Are they better? Worse?
Like every specialization, it's a matter of circumstance, the right tool for the job. Since the job is usually standing there and killing a bunch of monsters, I'd judge skirmisher to be the less useful specialization. Affliction spellcasters employ much safer strategies, and unless someone takes them out, are obnoxiously effective.
They need a team built around them, but they're worth building around. You keep a good affliction spellcaster safe, and it doesn't matter what or how much you're up against, they'll take it down eventually. The lead-in time hurts, but their efficiency and overall damage output is unparalleled.
The skirmisher can't match that?
Partially, yes, but they need a broader array of powers, which leaves them with shortfalls. This is why Asano was pegged as a generalist. The biggest weakness of a skirmisher are being far less effective against large numbers and the need to get in close. That is a high-risk proposition when you aren't quickly dropping targets like an assassination specialist. That's the low margin of error I mentioned.
There have to be advantages,
Yana said. Of course, Trenchant said. When what you need is skirmish tactics, a skirmisher is obviously better. A caster is better in standing fights, especially large-scale pitched battles, but not every enemy is so accommodating. Skirmishers are superior against hard targets that are solitary or in small groups. In the higher ranks, any monster that spawns alone is a significant threat. An affliction caster's team needs to stand their ground, but a dragon or Garuda will take them apart before the afflictions do their job. There were nods around the table. Rimuros adventurer culture was centered on specialist teams, and they all knew the results of sending the wrong team against the wrong threat. An affliction skirmisher is fine, and perhaps even best operating alone, Trenchin continued. They can work in teams, but at a bad fit for conventional ones, and at a bad choice to build a team around. They do best in misfit groups that focus on versatility, the exact opposite of the team-building ethos in Rimuros.
Then their main advantage is survivability? Vespa asked.
Yes. Although it's not just about the kind of powers they have, mentality is key. Affliction skirmishers are used to balancing on a sharp edge, so when things go wrong, they know how to handle it. Everyone at this table knows what to do if you find yourself up against a traditional affliction specialist. You get past the team and hit them, Ledev said. Then they're done. Exactly, Trenchant agreed. You know what I'd do if I was up against an affliction skirmisher? I'd run like the god of pain was chasing me. I wouldn't stand and fight unless I had a full team with me, and even then, I'd want a damn good reason. It's common knowledge that you have to kill an affliction specialist before they dose you, or you'll die even after you kill them. Skirmishers don't die easy.
So, in short, Vespa said, they're evil bastards.
Yes, Trenchant chuckled. If you ask me which affliction specialty is more useful, I'll pick caster every time. It's low skill, which means reliable, just churn through your abilities in the right order, and don't go further forward than the guy with the shield. Affliction skirmishers are like evasion-type defenders. It's all about judgment, skill, and margins of error. If they get it wrong, they die. The ones that make it into the higher ranks are extremely dangerous and excruciatingly difficult to kill. I believe that, Ledev said. I don't like Asano. I don't like his arrogance, and I don't like his disrespect. But when they made that man, they forgot the part that knows how to quit. We watched him in a fight he couldn't win, a fight we set him up for, so they knew his powers, and they were ready. But he never stopped struggling, not for a single moment. It wasn't just blind stubbornness, either. He looked for every edge, seized every advantage that would keep him alive for even a moment longer. I have to respect that kind of determination and resolve. If he fixed his attitude, he could be a fine adventurer.
A lot of things have tried to kill Jason Asano, Liara said. You can see it in the way he fights, in his aura and his scars.
You've seen his fully unleashed aura? Trenchant asked.
We saw him disable someone just with his aura, Yana said. It wasn't just shock from aura suppression either. It was like some kind of soul attack. I've never felt anything like it.
I know the phenomenon you're describing, Trenchant said. Have any of you worked with Amos Pensinata? Liara nodded.
He can make soul attacks as well, she said. Like Asano, he has suffered significant soul damage in the past and can now do things with his aura that other people can't. Like what?
Vespa asked. If there's nothing in Asano's file about it, I'm not going to say, Trenchant said. It's not my place to tell you other people's secrets. All this holds true to what I know about affliction skirmishers, though. Traditional training methods hurt them more than help. I've only seen a couple of great affliction skirmishers, and that was a long time ago. Both of them fought their way up from humble beginnings with not much more training than a few months mentored under another adventurer.
That's what Asano had. Some bronze rank adventurer showing him the ropes before he got plunged into deep water.
In your assessment, then, Vespa said, Asano can handle some high-profile contracts?
With respect, Your Highness, you've held a politician's meeting to assess an adventurer. If you want to know if he can handle a contract, give him one. And I'd recommend that you take one or two yourself. There's a monster surge on, and I think you could use the perspective.
On his way to the Adventure Society campus to see Liara, Jason accidentally opened a portal to the Market District teleportation square instead of the one on campus. Oops. Still, I need a few minutes before my portal is available again. I guess I'll have to go check out the local cheeses.
I am uncertain of who that statement is directed at, Mr. Asano.
Shade's voice came from Jason's shadow.
You know that you are lying. I certainly don't believe you, and even if anyone else were paying attention, I very much doubt they would care.
Someone's cranky today?
Gordon made me watch Jim Carter again.
Did you lose another bet?
I still think he's using those eye orbs to look at my cards somehow.
Then you should stop wagering. I thought you learned your lesson after he made you read the novelization of Kazam.
Mr. Asano, your world has dark and terrible things.
A short while later, Jason was feeding tiny chunks of fresh meat to the